Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Great American Westerns. Stories by Max Brand, Zane Grey, Alan LeMay, Cynthia Hasselhoff, Mark Twain, Frank Bonham, and Peter Dawson. Narrated by Terrence Acil Ford, Ken Jackson, and Mort Shelby. With performances by Alexander Strain, Thomas Keegan, Tim Carlin, Colleen Delaney, Scott McCormick, Michael Glenn, Nanette Savard, Tony Nam, Elizabeth Jernigan, Joe Brack, David Coyne, Richard Rowan, Tim Getman, Christopher Graybill, Danny Gavigan, Drew Copas, Michael John Casey, Alyssa Wilmoth, Richard Cutting, Gary Tells, Kimberly Gilbert, and Evan Casey. Great American Westerns, Volume 4. Werewolf by Max Brand. All day the storm gathered behind Chimney Mountain, and now and again peered around the edges of that giant with a scowling brow. And all day there had been strainings of the wind and sounds of dim confusion in the upper air. But not until the evening did the storm break. The broad, yellow-cheeked moon sailed up the eastern sky when 10,000 wild horses of darkness rushed out from behind Mount Chimney and covered the heavens. Dashes and scatterings of rain fell, and hail began to clang on the tin roofs in the alley, and the wind kept up an insane whining, now and then leaping against window or door and shaking them in a frenzy. On such a night as this, few men got as far as Yates's saloon beyond the outskirts of the town of Royal. But nevertheless, Yates was always glad to have this weather, for those who did come stayed long and opened their purses with as much freedom as though the morrow was to be doomsday, and as though their souls needed much warming with honest rye whiskey against that great event. Mr. Yates had two rooms. The bar in one sported a round iron stove at one end where the guests might warm themselves, and a row of chairs against the walls. One of the maxims of Yates had to do with the evils of drinking while standing. He was engaged in giving good advice at this moment to a youth who rested one elbow on the edge of the bar and poised the other fist upon his hip. A tall, strong, fierce young man who smiled down at the saloon keeper, partly in contempt for the advice, and partly in mild recognition of the privilege of white hairs.
Give me another slug of the red eye, old man.
Mr. Yates filled the glass with an unwilling shake of the head. He pushed it back across the bar and gathered in the 50-cent piece.
You can't hurry liquor, my son. Whiskey is something that can't be rushed. You gotta go slow and easy, let it mellow you. Treat it with caution. Then whiskey will stand your friend.
Yeah, all right. Never mind the change. Give me another, will you? And then you can talk some more.
I don't know that I ought to let you drink another so quick.
You don't know? I know, though. Fill up that glass.
The five other men in the barroom, their chairs tilted against the wall, swung softly forward and raised their heads.
I tell you, lad, the whiskey which will be a friend to the wise man can turn into a devil if he's treated carelessly. You can't crowd it into a corner. You can't treat it like a slave.
Yeah, what'll it do?
The boy stretched out his arm with a movement of sneaky speed and wrenched the bottle from the hands of the saloon keeper and filled his glass with such careless violence that an extra quantity spilled upon the well-rubbed varnish of the bar.
What's this stuff gonna do to me?
Mr. Yates did not attempt to protest against the act of violence, but a dark flush spread over his face.
It'll take you by the throat, strangle you. It'll send a bullet into your back. It'll throw you under the feet of a mad horse. Or it'll kill you with the horrors if it feels like it.
Yeah.
The youngster shrugged his shoulders.
I don't understand what you're driving at, and I don't know that I give a damn. Is there any writing paper in that other room?
There was still more contention upon the tip of the tongue of Yates, but he controlled himself with an effort. For words flow more willingly from the lips of an old man than water from a rich spring.
There's always paper there, and welcome.
There was no answer to this courtesy. The cowboy turned from the bar and kicked open the door. He drew a chair up to a table, and after that, silence settled on the second room, and silence engulfed the bar. The five farmers and cowhands smoked their pipes or cigarettes and watched the thoughtful cloud upon the brow of their host.
Who is he?
Him? Didn't you have a fair look at him?
One of the cowboys squinted for a better look.
Oh, it's Cliff Maine. I knew him over in Redosa Valley a few years back. I'm sure it's him.
Yeah, it's the same man.
The first farmer's face shone in recognition.
Why, partner, that's the name of Harry Maine's brother.
Again, the saloonkeeper nodded.
It's him.
This was followed by a deeper, longer silence, and more than one apprehensive glance was cast at the door of the second room. One of the weather-beaten farmhands approached the bar and leaned against it.
Tell me, is he like Harry?
He hooked a thumb over his shoulder.
You can see for yourself. No, he ain't a killer, you might say. He's gone straight enough, but still he ain't any lamb.
The farmer shuddered a little.
What's his game here?
It's that girl up the valley, the one that young Royal is after.
Which Royal?
I mean Christopher.
It's the Lassiter girl that this Chris Royal goes with, ain't it?
That's the one. They say that Maine seen her at a dance down in Phoenix last year, and it addled his head a good deal. So I guess that's why he's here.
The other farmer shook his head.
That would be a thing. A Lassiter to look at a Maine, eh?
Well, I seen stranger things happen. Pretty girl takes to a strong man, and a strong man takes to a pretty girl. Goodness and badness ain't considered much, and neither is the poor old family tree. But that ain't the point. Georgie Lassiter, she's got one strong man already, and that ought to be enough. I guess no woman can ask for more than the Royal, eh?
He leaned on the edge of the bar.
I guess that no woman could ask for more than that.
He shook his head slowly, and the others nodded in understanding, as though they were all familiar with the qualities of the family that gave its name to the valley and to the town. In the meantime, the storm kept rising and quickening like the pulse of a sick man's heart. The very roof seemed about to blow free. A contrary gust came down the chimney and knocked a puff of smoke through every crack of the stove.
Whew, what a night.
I'll take another whiskey.
And me.
We'll set them up all around. I say, I don't mind a night like this, when you can sit warm around the fire with something to keep your heart up. But I can tell you about a night that was a twin brother to this, except that it was in February with ice in the wind. I was back up in Montana that winter, riding range for an outfit that was...
The door quivered and then jerked open. The wind, like an entering flood of water, made every man cringe in his place. With that burst of the storm came a big young man who thrust the door shut behind him with a strong hand. He strode to the bar, stamping the water out of his soaked riding boots and shaking the rain out of his hat. He was neither beaten nor even embittered by the force of the wind and the rain. It had merely brought a rosy glow into his face and dimmed the brightness of his eyes a bit with moisture.
Well, Chris Royal, what are you having?
Nothing. I'm bound home, you see, and Mother doesn't like me to have liquor on my breath. I stopped to put my mare in your shed for a feed and a bit of rest. She was tired from bucking this wind all the way up the valley.
He broke off to speak to the other men in the room.
Hello, boys.
And as he completed that little ceremony and had asked after their welfare, you might have put him down as the son of a great landed proprietor on whose estates all these men were living, so that their welfare, in a way, was his. However, that was not the case. But the Royals had been so long in the valley, had given it its name, and had dominated all affairs in it, that they were placed in a truly patriarchal position. There were no political parties in Royal County, or in Royal Valley, for instance. There were only the royal partisans and their opponents. And the opponents were sure to be merely a scattered and spiteful handful. In other ways, too, the family dominated the region.
No drink! Look here, Christopher. You know that if you don't drink, you're missing one of the best things in life?
I take a drink now and then. I like it as well as most, I suppose. But it bothers Mother to have me do it, so I don't when I'm going toward her, you see.
Ah, well.
Mr. Yates held up a bottle toward the light.
Here's something 25 years old that I was going to offer you a sip of. But heaven knows that I'd make trouble between no boy and his mother. She's a grand lady, Christopher. And amazing how well she carries her years, ain't it?
Years? Years?
Well, she's getting on, ain't she?
I never thought of that. She isn't really old, you know?
No, not old. Not old. But when we have white hair...
Her silver hair is beautiful. It's always been silver, you know? As far back as I can remember.
I can remember farther back than that, though. I can remember when she first came to Royal Valley. It was a dark, mean day, and she come in a covered carriage all made snug. But I had a glimpse of her through the carriage window and saw her face all pink and white and her yellow hair like a pool of sunshine in the shadows of the carriage.
Christopher shook his head.
I can hardly think my mother was ever like that.
Christopher smiled in a rather bewildered way.
But you mustn't call her old.
Why, Chris, at 60, you can't exactly call her young, can you?
60?
Christopher began to think back.
Well, I'm 25, Duncan's 28, Edgerton is 31, and Samson is 35.
By heavens, you're right. And she's 60 years old. I should never have guessed that. One doesn't connect years and time with her.
He smiled at Yates.
And you're one of the unchangeables, too. You've never been any different, have you? Not in my lifetime.
Well, lad, well, I do well enough. I just shrink and shrivel a bit as time goes on. I get a little whiter and a little drier. There's less hair for me to bother about combing from year to year. But I don't change much. Neither does the old place.
You put a new wing on the shed, though.
Well, you notice that, eh?
Yeah. Who'd you have do the work?
Well, I had the slaves of Adam here.
Yates held out his two hands.
You did it all yourself? You are a rare old one. If there were more like you, there'd be no room for the youngsters in the world. You'd take all the work away from us.
You Chris Royal?
Christopher turned about and looked into the dark eyes of Cliff Main.
I'm Christopher Royal.
The other stepped up and faced him at the bar.
I started to find you today. Then the rain dropped on me and I put in here. I want to have a talk with you, Royal.
A talk? Where?
Well, there's an empty room back here. We might go there.
Christopher regarded the newcomer rather dubiously for a moment, but then he nodded and followed him into the other apartment. The door closed behind Main, and the lock turned.
Hello?
The saloon keeper started around from behind the bar.
I don't like that.
What are you gonna do, Yates?
One of the farmhands caught his sleeve as he passed.
I'm gonna have that door open.
Now, don't you do it. You know Main. Don't take more than a little thing like that to send Harry Main crazy. And his brother looks like the same kind of gunpowder.
Yates paused, biting his lip with anxiety.
Besides, there ain't gonna be no trouble. It ain't as though Duncan or Edgerton or Samson Royal was in there. Christopher, he's softer than the rest. He's easier, quieter. He's more like a girl, you'd say, compared to his older brothers. He can get on with anybody. I never heard of Chris having an enemy.
And that's all gospel.
Yates went back behind the bar. He paused now and again and shook his head.
I don't like that locked door. I remember once, me and my wife had a bad quarrel, and it started with me locking the door. And when I wanted to open that door, I lost the key.
The sudden uproar of the wind and its loud whistling beneath the door caused the human voices to fall away. The wind itself dropped to a murmur.
I'll tell you, man, I don't want any trouble with you. I swear that I've never done you any harm.
All the six in the barroom looked mutely at one another with great eyes.
It's a whiskey. I might have known it. I told him when he was pouring it down that way. I've seen it happen before. And I tell you, that door will never be unlocked until there's been hell to pay inside.
He rushed out from behind the bar and went to the door.
Open the door!
There was a sudden sound of thunderous scuffling within, and then a heavy body crashed against the door. Yates shrank away.
Why don't you do something? Ain't they in there killing each other? Ain't there five of you big and strong and young to stop them? Why do you sit there with your hands hanging?
They looked at one another, these five. Surely they were as strong and as brave as most men. But the sound and the thought of the battle which was raging beyond that door baffled and overawed them. They could not move to help. Perhaps in another instant they would have recovered their courage and been able to act, but the whole duration of the scuffle within the other room lasted only a single moment. Then they heard the key in the lock.
May heaven forgive me, but I'm gonna die with poor young Chris or revenge him.
He picked up a shotgun from behind the bar and laid it level with the opening door, his old face white and tense with savage energy. The door swung wide, and Christopher Royal stepped out. Their sense of suspense had been as great as if they had been forced to stand by while a man was caged with a tiger. And now the man came forth alive. In the hand of Christopher hung a big Colt, with a thin wisp of smoke still clinging to its muzzle like a ghost.
He's dead, I think. I wish that some of you would go and see.
They poured into the writing room. It was half a wreck. One could see that two very strong men wrestled here, and whatever they touched gave way. Cliff Mayne lay in the corner on his back with a smudge of blood across his face. There was no reason for a second glance. He'd been shot fairly through the brain. They went back into the bar room. Yates hastily filled a glass with whiskey and, in silence, placed it beside the youngster. He gripped it eagerly and then pushed it away.
She wouldn't like it.
He raised his head and, seeming to discover the gun in his hand or to remember it for the first time, he threw it on the bar and shuddered violently. He was white, with a look of sickness in his face, but he stood extremely steady and quiet.
Is your telephone working in spite of the storm, Yates?
It's working, Chris.
Then I want you to ring up the sheriff and tell him what's happened out here.
I'll do that.
There's nothing to be done for him, I suppose.
For Maine? No, he's dead, Chris.
I thought so. What'd you say his name was?
Cliff Maine. Harry Maine's brother.
Harry Maine's brother?
He took the glass of whiskey, which was standing on the bar. He tossed it off, and then without another word, he strode away into the night.
Look at
him. Yates addressed the door through which his guest had just disappeared.
Look at him. And you call him soft. I tell you, even Harry Maine wouldn't get any better than his brother if he should have come along to even things up. There's something in the royal blood, and it can't be beat. It can't be damned. Did you notice him when he came out from that room? Sick looking, because it had been a dirty job and a dirty set at the finish. But like a rock, hey?
He rubbed his hands together.
As for the killing of Cliff Maine, you was all here to witness how Maine carried on from first to last, wasn't you?
We seen it all.
They'll never lay a hand on Chris for this. It's only Harry Maine that he's got to think about. And I thank heaven that I ain't in the boots of Chris Royal.
The wind had changed, so that as Christopher Royal rode up the valley, the rain was volleyed at him from the side, stinging his face until he was forced to cant his head against it. It was an automatic movement. The howling of the wind and crashing of the rain, which had seemed terrible enough to him before, were now as nothing. For there was a war in his spirit that overwhelmed mere disturbances of nature. He had killed a man. To Christopher, the miracle was that in the crisis, with his back against the wall, his skill with a gun, built up by many a long year of practice, by many a strenuous hunting season, did not desert him. When the need came, mechanically, the weapon glided into his hand and he shot swift and true. So swift and true, Cliff Maine could not complete his own draw before the pellet of lead crashed through his brain. But suppose he had known the name of the man was Maine. Suppose he knew this was none other than a brother to the famous fighting man Harry Maine. What then? Convulsive shudders ran through the body of Christopher, and in the blackness of the night, with the rush of the storm about him, he told himself again the secret about himself no one other than the Almighty and his own soul ever acknowledged before.
I'm nothing but a coward.
How, then, could he have come to the age of 25 years without that weakness publicly exposed by the rough men of Royal Valley where he spent his life? The simple answer, his family stood above the shadow of reproach. They filled the mountains with their deeds over generations, and this present brood seemed to have improved upon the old stock rather than fallen away from the good tradition. In a riding or a hunting or a shooting contest, one could be sure one of the Royals would win. And when it came to fighting, why, who was apt to forget that the scars on the face of Samson Royal came in hand-to-hand battle with a grizzly? Who could fail to know that Edgerton Royal rode single-handed into Pinckneysville when he served as deputy sheriff and came out again herding two prisoners before him, prisoners he took away from beneath the eyes of 100 of their friends? As for Peter Royal, he proved worthy of his spurs on that dire night when the three Mexicans cornered him, and only a year before, Duncan Royal shot out an argument with two men on the Chimney Trail. So they were all proven, with only the youngest of the brood, Christopher, to make his name. Yet it hardly needed making. Men took it for granted that one royal would perform as good as another. There might be little differences, but the world generally agreed all were lions. Pick which one you would.
And I'm a lamb.
They looked alike, too. That is to say, the smallest of them all, Samson, stood a full 2 inches above 6 feet, and the tallest of them, Duncan, towered a palm's breadth above his older brother. They all had the same sort of shoulders, filling a door as they went through it. And concerning their might of hand, wonderful and beautiful fables filled the land. How Samson twisted the iron bar in the blacksmith shop in Royal Town. Behold, it still hangs against the wall for proof. And how Edgerton could take 2 packs of playing cards and tear them across. And how Christopher himself lifted the entire bulk of a horse. Such stories filled the mountains with echoes. And since not one of the band had ever been found weak in any manner of physical or nervous test, folks took for granted that all were of the same true, pure steel. But one person in all the world knew the facts. He knew that Duncan and Edgerton and Samson and Peter were all undoubted heroes with hearts even stronger than their hands. But he knew also of one fatally weak link in the chain of brotherhood. Christopher. For Christopher, over his years, had felt a weakness in his spirit. He had waited for the dreaded moment when he should be tested. Or could it be the family name and fame would shield him all his life?
I couldn't stand that. But must I?
In his school days, he had not so much as guessed at it. No matter how mighty the tradition his brothers left behind in the little white schoolhouse by the river, Christopher had not been overawed. The height of Duncan's jump and the width of Peter's leap and the speed of Samson on foot, the weight of Edgerton's fist remained as legend in the school. But young Christopher bided his time and surpassed them one by one. He was just as strong as they. He was a little more supple, a little more graceful, a little more brilliantly swift and sure of hand. And other graces had been lavished upon him, as though nature, who framed his brothers on so magnificent a scale, had merely practiced for the moment when she would create Christopher. So she made the others big and glorious, but she gave to Christopher the gift of beauty also. The others were dark. She made him fair. A touch of gloom shadowed the others, as often occurs with big men, but Christopher she made joyous from the beginning. So that altogether, if the citizens of Royal Valley felt bound to select one of the family as the representative of all the best and finest in them, they would have picked Christopher with almost one voice. There were a few, of course, unimpressed by his gentleness. But in this lavishness of hers, nature forgot the prime and essential gift. She left out the vital spark of courage. And though no man knew it except Christopher himself, he passed through many a dreadful moment when he stood face to face with his secret. Now the very secrecy enveloping the fault stood threatened. For as certainly as lightning strikes, Harry Mayne would come to avenge the death of his brother. And when Harry Mayne came to seek revenge...
What'll I do?
In his desperation, he vowed that he would go out to meet the destroyer, and in some hidden place, with no man to see, he would fight and die. Yet in his heart of hearts, he constantly knew he would not be able to meet the great test. When Harry Mayne approached the valley, Christopher would slink away and never again dare to show his face among his kin. Somewhere far off, he would have to find a new place in the world, a new name, and there... live out his wretched destiny. When he thought of these things, it was typical of Christopher that he did not think of the faces of his 4 strong brothers, hard with scorn and contempt. But the picture that rose before him was of 2 women. One, his mother. The other, the lovely Georgia Lassiter, who always carried her head so jauntily high. Christopher knew the reason she loved him so passionately was not so much for himself, his mind, and his spirit, as because of an ideal of manhood she had conceived and which she grafted on to Christopher. She loved not him, but her idea of him. And if once she guessed at such a dreadful taint as cowardice, she would replace all her love with a fiery disgust.
And what a mother!
When Christopher thought of her, his heart bowed almost to the mud of the road. What she would think and do and say, he couldn't guess. He knew the sternness that underlay her motherhood, and he knew the iron of her pride and her family. He reached the turning from the main road and saw before him the avenue of poplars, their heads shaken and bent beneath the fierce hand of the wind. Down the gravel drive, he galloped the tired mare and so wound into view of the royal house itself, with its lofty front and its romantic wooden battlements. From the top of the neighboring hills, the naked eye could see Royal House like a great natural landmark of the valley, and from directly beneath, it looked rather like a great palace than the residence of a rich rancher.
How can I shrivel with fear and still live in that house?
Behind its wide-flung arms stood the sheds, the barns, and the maze of the corrals, where the weaker cattle found shelter and feed through the severer winters. There, too, stood the quarters for the hired men. And day and night, for all these years, there had never a moment passed when smoke did not rise from some chimney in that group of buildings. Christopher, looking at it all and thinking of what it meant, felt again what he often felt in his childhood. That big and strong as all his brothers were, his father, who built these things, must have seemed even to them as a giant to pygmies. And his mother lived as the proper wife of such a man. Still, she ruled the establishment with a power as firm as it was mild. And even her eldest son dreaded her quiet voice more than the booming of a cannon. Christopher grew up a little different. He grew up the baby of the family, the petted one. For having raised so many sons so well, even such a woman as Marcia Royal could afford to relax a little and favor her youngest child.
Maybe I needed a little more hide and a little less heart.
If he passed through the same stern school as the others, might he not have developed, like them, the same iron core to his spirit? Might he not have grown, like them, into a hero of heart and hand also? He gave the mare to his stable boy. Then he turned to the house, and as he walked, he wondered how he should tell the story. And what would the others say? He decided that he would say nothing for the time being. So he went into the living room and found them all, except Samson, gathered in easy chairs near the fire on the open hearth. He changed his clothes, and when he came down again, he found his mother had a cup of hot coffee waiting for him. She stood behind his chair with her hands on his shoulders while he drank it.
Christopher, dear, you shouldn't have come out on such a night. You know that.
I tried to telephone from Woolley's, but the line was down in the wind, I think. I was afraid you'd worry if you didn't hear from me, so I came on out.
And why not telephone from Yates's place and stay there the rest of the night?
He didn't have a chance to answer, for just then Samson came in and fixed his dark eyes instantly and firmly upon the face of his youngest brother, so that Christopher understood Samson knew all that had happened. There was something so unusual about Samson's air that the others noticed it instantly. For that matter, the oldest brother of the royal family was always so direct, so fiercely sincere, that it was not usually difficult to understand the goings-on in his mind. He came across the room after a moment and stared down at Christopher, who stirred uneasily beneath that glance. Afterwards, Samson went before the fire and stood with his back to it until steam began to rise from his wet clothes.
Now what is it, Sammy?
Samson was the only member of the family that dared disregard for an instant a direct remark from his mother. In place of answering, he suddenly put back his head and shook with silent laughter.
Samson!
At this, he came to himself with a start.
What on earth is the matter with you?
Nothing, Mother.
My dear, you must tell me at once. You make me nervous.
Samson allowed a broad smile to appear over his face while he stared straight across the room directly at Christopher.
Look there.
There is Christopher, of course. You are really rude, Samson. Now, what about Christopher?
I don't know what you mean. What should there be about him?
Don't beat about the bush, Samson.
You haven't heard. He wouldn't say anything about it. He doesn't want to shock you. I'll tell you what. This old Christopher of ours, whom we've always thought so gentle, he's a lion under that fleece. I've always guessed it, and tonight he's proven it.
Mrs. Royal turned on her youngest son.
Christopher, what have you done?
Christopher stirred in his chair and tried to answer, but he could only shake his head.
I can't talk about it.
It was too much. Nasty business. He doesn't want to talk about it. Doesn't want to at all. Well, I'll tell you what happened. I came up the road to Yates Saloon and got there just after Chris left. I heard what had happened, and I saw.
What was it, Sammy, in the name of heaven?
Why, I'll tell you what it was. I found there the proof that Chris is your real son, Mother.
Have you doubted that? Did you think he was a foundling?
Mrs. Royal looked fondly at her youngest son. Samson went over to her and dropped his big hands on her shoulders.
You understand, Mother, that it was always easy to see that Chris was like you in one way, like the gentler side of you. But we didn't think that he had your iron.
Am I iron, Sammy dear?
You may smile at me, Mother, but you can't fool me. Yes, you are iron in the time when iron is needed. And if you hadn't been a woman, you would have made as hard a man as ever stepped.
That needs some explaining, foolish boy.
Well, we all remember that time that the Krogan dog went mad and tried to get at us, and how you stood it off with your walking stick.
That was a horrible day.
No, you liked it. I'll never forget how your eyes shone as you stood up to that wild foaming beast.
Tush, Sammy. But I want to hear about Christopher.
Well, about Christopher.
Samson turned his powerful, homely face toward Christopher.
I'll tell you. But watch him squirm. Watch him wriggle while I talk.
Don't be too ridiculous, Samson. Just tell me the facts.
There were several facts. To begin with, Chris was at the Yates place this evening. And so were several others. And one of them was young Maine.
A sudden stiffening took hold in the attitudes of all of the family. The giant Duncan sat alert.
You mean Harry Maine's younger brother?
A ruffian like his brother Harry.
Samson nodded.
Look at Mother's eyes shine. She's gentle. No iron about her.
Samson, I don't want to hear any more of this.
You can't help it, Chris. You simply can't help hearing it.
I can, though, and I shall.
And Christopher strode hurriedly from the room.
Now will you tell us before we all go mad?
It was like this. Cliff Maine had come to the place of Yates, poured down some stiff whiskeys, and then gone into the next room to write a letter. Then Chris came in. He wouldn't drink. Not when he was riding home to his mother.
Samson paused and grinned.
My darling Christopher.
He's a darling, a perfect lamb. Wait until you hear the end of this yarn, though.
I want to hear it if you'll only get on.
Maine came out of the other room and found Christopher.
The sudden opening of the door caused everyone to start. It was Christopher coming back. A pale and shaken Christopher.
Samson, I want you to stop making such nonsense over what happened.
Well?
I'll tell them myself exactly what happened. Since you have to know the truth about the miserable affair.
Go on, old man. Of course we have to know.
Cliff Maine made me leave the barroom with him. We went into that other little room. The moment we were alone, he grew insulting. And after a time, when he saw that I wanted to be friendly and keep out of trouble, he grew overbearing, horribly so. And finally, he said that he happened to be interested in Georgia Lassiter, and that that was reason enough for me to stop paying attention to her.
Christopher, his eyes closed, rested a hand against the wall.
I couldn't quite stand for that, you know, and I had to tell him that the thing wouldn't do.
And then?
Christopher stood, recalling the moment. The sinking of his heart, and the sickness of his spirit, and the manner in which he felt himself slipping into a sea of darkness. Another instant and he would have begged for mercy. Another instant and he would have tried to flee from the room. But the brutal Maine did not give him an instant. Christopher saw a flash of a hand toward a gun. He instinctively moved to make his own draw, and he'd made it first.
And then he started for his gun. I had to start for mine. The bullet passed through his brain.
Christopher sank down in a chair, overcome by horror. His mother was suddenly beside him, her arm around him.
Oh, Chris, my dear boy, I know. No matter what a brute he was a human being. But now that you've done this thing, there'll never be any need for you to do another. You detest bloodshed, and having proved that you're a man who cannot be tampered with safely, the others will be sure to leave you alone. Oh, dear boy, how my heart aches.
He did not answer. He couldn't look at her. She thought his horror grew from his taking a life, but it didn't. It was horror at the knowledge of how close he had been to a nervous collapse, to a complete hysteria of cowardice.
But you're wrong, Mother.
Edgerton Royal, the logician of the family, looked at his mother and Christopher.
You're quite wrong. Before this week's out, there'll be another gunfight on the hands of Chris.
What do you mean?
Think for yourself. Will Harry Maine allow the man who killed his brother to get on without another fight?
Harry Maine! That murderer, that gunfighter! No. You will all band together and prevent him. You'll all meet him and crush him.
Wait. Peter Royal, the judge of the family, spoke up.
Wait, Mother, and tell me if you yourself would allow other people to fight your battles if you were a man.
She hesitated. Christopher, his face buried in his hands, waited breathlessly.
No, I couldn't. And not a one of you will be different. Not a one of you will want to help poor Chris, though every one of you would die to avenge him. But oh, what a dreadful trial for my poor Chris. Such a man as Harry Maine.
Samson, the mighty, the ugly of face, the steely-hearted, beamed.
Chris will beat him. Let these gentlefellas get the taste of blood, and they're worse than the worst of the gunfighters that are born hard and mean. I'm a prophet. You wait and see what happens. For a million, I wouldn't be in the boots of that fella, Harry Maine.
Harry Maine. To Christopher, it was as though he'd been thinking about a great tiger rather than a man. Harry Maine, he would as soon stand up to a thunderbolt as to that destroyer. What was Cliff Maine compared to such a devil of a man? He waited. A pause of solemnity had come in the talk of the room. And in that solemnity, he knew that every one of the stern and strong brothers stood resolved that the battle must be fought out man to man. Christopher's last hope turned to ash faster than the logs on the hearth. Sleep came to him that night as a most unexpected guest. The morning dawned to find him 12 hours nearer, not to death, but to his humiliation. For all thought of standing for the trial of courage against Harry Maine had left him. But knowing that in the crisis he would not be present, he was able to put on a smile when he went down to breakfast. The others greeted him with a forced cheerfulness which made him feel that they already thought him as good as dead. Only his mother did not smile, but sat very sternly erect, her eyes looking far away. What schemes might be passing through that formidable brain of hers, equal to any man's? After breakfast, Peter called him to one side.
Here's that Winchester of mine that you've always liked, Chris. I want you to have it.
Peter hurried away, leaving Christopher more thoughtful than ever. For his brother Peter was a great hunter, and this was his favorite rifle. He always bragged about it when they were out hunting.
This gun has a will and a way of its own in shooting straight to the mark.
Such a gift meant a great deal. It was more than a rifle. It was as though Peter had parted from some of the strength of his very soul. And to be sure, Harry Maine was as apt to fight with a rifle as with a revolver. Various stories of his prowess passed through the mind of Christopher. He remembered that old tale of how the four Brownell brothers set out on the trail of Harry Maine and shot him from behind. How he dragged himself from his fallen horse to a nest of rocks, bandaged his wound, and fought them off through all of a hot, windless day among the mountains. Three of the Brownell boys he killed outright. Jack Brownell, with a bullet through his shoulder, rode 15 miles to get to a doctor. As for Harry Maine, he needed no doctor. The man cured his own hurts. That was one eloquent testimonial to the skill of Harry with a rifle. Christopher's face contorted a little in unwilling sympathy as he thought of the injured man dragging himself about among the rocks and firing at some momentarily exposed bit of an enemy among the adjacent rocks. However, though rifles were a possibility, revolvers were far more likely. And as for the examples of the hardihood of Maine with a Colt, there were a dozen to select from, each well nigh as incredible as the other. Perhaps none seemed quite so startling as that tale of how, when he was little more than a boy, he followed three Mexican cattle thieves who raided his father's little ranch, followed them over 1,000 miles until the trail crossed the Rio Grande, And on the other side of that famous river, he encountered them in broad daylight, unexpectedly, at a bend of the road. All three opened fire, but Harry, escaped without so much as a wound, laid the three dead with three bullets, then turned and began the long march back toward the ranch, driving the lean cattle ahead of him. That had been revolver work, and upon a revolver, it was most likely that Harry would depend now. So Christopher took a pair of Colts and a loaded ammunition belt. He went back behind the house to a quiet little dell where the poplars walked in their slender beauty along the banks of a winding stream. It was an unforgettable spot in the mind of Christopher, because at this place he first told Georgia Lassiter that he loved her.
Chris, I always loved you. I always will.
It gave him seclusion now. With his heavy knife, he sliced a blaze on the faces of six posts. And then, at 20 paces distance, he walked rapidly past those posts and put a shot in each. He examined them afterward. A bullet had cut through the heart of each white spot, except for one, where the pellet had torn through the margin of the blaze. But even so, it would have touched the heart had that post been a man. He was infinitely pleased with his exhibition of skill. Not that it determined him any the more strongly to remain and wait for the coming of Harry Maine into the valley, but because he had worked for so many years to make himself expert with weapons that there was a meager satisfaction in seeing to what a point his skill had attained. He went on to other little bits of marksmanship. He would select a tree, mark it with a blaze, and then turn his back upon it, close his eyes, and whirling rapidly around, look and fire all in an instant. It was terribly trying work. He missed the blaze three times out of four, but still he always managed at least to strike the tree trunk. Then he had another little exercise of skill which he often worked at. If you knock a man down with your first bullet, he may still shoot and kill you while he lies bleeding and sprawling on the ground. So he marked trees with a double blaze, one head high and one against the roots. And he began to fire his shots in pairs. Sap oozed from the killing wounds he made in the tender saplings. He changed from that to picking up bits of wood or stones and tossing them high in the air, then whipping out a revolver and firing at the flying target. Once in three times, he hit with his first shot, and half of the remainder he managed to smash with a second shot. But one in three fell to the ground untouched. However, such shooting could never be made perfect. And it was a wonderful test and training for speed and accuracy of hand and eye combined. Three times in succession, he tossed high into the air a stone no larger than his palm in size. And three times in succession, he blew it into a puff of powder with a well-planted bullet. His final shot dissolved the last bit of sandstone into a glimmering mist dancing on the fading sunlight. From the side of the meadow, Georgia Lassiter rode out to him on the little white-stocking chestnut he gave her the year before. She was the last person in the world he wanted to see. All the rest he could give up and endure their loss, even his mother. But Georgia held a different place altogether. She swung down from the saddle and into his arms, and she stood there, holding him close and straining back her head a little from him to look up into his face.
You'll beat even Harry Maine. You can't fail. It really isn't in a royal to fail, Christopher.
Mother has told you then.
Your mother didn't need to tell me, because everyone in the valley is talking about nothing else. Last night, the telephones were simply humming with the news. And everyone says the same thing, Chris. You'll beat him. Because an honest man is stronger than any scoundrel and thief.
Is Harry Maine a thief?
He is. He is.
Georgia never failed to defend her opinions with vehemence.
A man who picks pockets is a thief when he only takes away a watch or a wallet. Then what about a villain who uses his greater training and cleverness to steal the lives of other men? Isn't he a thief? A murdering thief?
He always uses fair fight, Georgia.
I know, and there's something grand and terrible about Harry Maine. But still, when I stood there and watched you practicing, Christopher, I couldn't see how any man in the world could safely face you.
There's a difference between target practice and practice at a living target, you know.
Oh, you seem so pale and gloomy, dear.
He looked vaguely at her like a child, hardly seeing her, and yet keenly aware of details, such as the depth of tan in the hollow of her throat and the trembling in the wind of the cornflower at her breast.
I'm not very cheerful.
He waited to see if that would make her guess anything.
Well, there's Lurcher, too, looking as if you just beaten him.
Lurcher was a melancholy crossbred hound, a very ugly beast that once strayed down the road to the Royal Ranch and there stayed, adopting Christopher as his particular sovereign deity. But he would never follow Christopher farther than the limits of the ranch, which he seemed to know by a peculiar instinct. Even when there was a hunt, he would not follow a trail beyond the borders of the royal estate. For Lurcher passed through many a dreadful trial, it seemed, in his earlier life. He now fixed his determination to remain as much as possible on the soil where he found freedom from persecution. Now he skulked in from the edge of the meadow and lay down in the shadow of his master, raising his mournful eyes toward the girl.
I never beat Lurcher.
I wish that you would. It might do him good. It would stop him from thinking so much about his troubles by giving him something to worry about.
He's not a bad dog. He does things, you know.
He drew his hunting knife and threw it dexterously so that it stuck in a poplar trunk 30 feet away.
Get it, Lurcher!
The hound trotted obediently over, worked the blade from the trunk, and came back, wagging his tail with joy to lay the knife at his master's feet, and then raise his sorrowful eyes in worship toward the face of Christopher.
Without cutting himself.
You see, Georgia? He's not such a bad dog.
But he's a coward, Chris. And I never could understand how a royal could endure any cowardly creature near.
This was pressing him very close, and he winced from the thought.
He's not cruel, or treacherous, or unkind, or bullying, or underhanded, or disloyal, Georgia. You have to admit that that's a good deal to say for any character.
Is it? Well, I tell you, Chris, it really doesn't amount to anything. What's the good of friendship that doesn't dare fight for the sake of its friend? What's the good of love that won't die for the thing that's loved? Can you answer me that?
He went back to the house with Georgia at his side, sitting lightly in her saddle.
All the rest seem to think that it's the same as sure death to have Harry Mayne go on the trail of a man. But I don't feel that way. I know that courage and right have a force in the world. I thank heaven for that faith. And I want to have our engagement announced tomorrow, before anything can happen to you.
He caught at the bridle of her horse, but she reined the chestnut dexterously out of his reach.
Georgia! George, do you mean that?
Why, of course I mean that, silly.
And then, suppose something happens.
Something may happen to you, but that won't kill my love for you, dear. You don't suppose that because a bullet might strike you down, Chris, it would strike down my love also? No, I laugh at such an idea. I have no fear of myself. And once I've let the world know that I love Christopher Royal and intend to marry him, I'll never change my mind. Nothing can change it. And I tell you, Chris, that I'd be as true to your ghost as to yourself.
He listened and watched her, and thought that there was something rather more knightly than womanly in her bearing. It seemed odd to Christopher that his mother and this girl, both so deeply in his life, should have such a strength between them, and he such a weakness.
George, I wish...
What do you wish?
I wish there didn't have to be any change, but that the two of us could just go on like this forever. No tomorrow, no yesterday.
You'd get hungry after a while.
That's the way the gods live. Always in the present, with no sorrow for what has been and no dread of what is to come.
Chris, you're talking like a pagan priest.
To be like this, Georgia dear, with you on your horse, within the sweep of my arm, and I here beside you, and the good, rich, yellow sunshine pouring down on us both, and the face of that river always silver ahead of us. Don't laugh, if you please.
I won't laugh. You frighten me when you talk like that.
Frighten you? You?
Do you think that I can never be frightened?
Yes, I've always thought that.
I tell you what, Chris. If something happens... Oh, why should I beat about the bush? I mean, suppose that Harry Mayne actually kills you. I'll have to go the rest of my life like this. I mean, with my back turned on what's around me. And always looking away on the times when you and I were together and alone. There ain't many of those times. I suppose that I'll begin to wonder why I didn't spend every moment with you while I had the chance, and why I didn't beg you to marry me quickly, and why I didn't have a baby to keep after you. And, oh, I'm getting so sorry for myself that I'll be crying in another minute.
Christopher couldn't answer, for such a coldness of dread and of sorrow had grown up in him that he felt the very nerves of his knees unstrung, and a horrible weakness of spirit passing over him.
Georgia, you better go on home.
No, I want to talk with your mother first.
Oh, there's no good in that.
You understand? I don't want to talk about Harry Maine. I don't want to think about him until I have to.
She swung the chestnut closer and dropped her arm over his shoulders.
I know. That's the right way. Not to worry about the game until it has to be played. But Heaven won't dare let Harry Maine win.
He looked up to answer her. She kissed him and then galloped the chestnut away. He watched her across the fields. Lurcher, who had followed the galloping pony to the first fence, stood up with a forefoot resting on the lower rail and looked after her. Lurcher let out a low whine, the nearest approach to a voice of any kind that people had ever heard him use. Christopher felt something wonderfully touching in the dumb excitement and grief of the dog.
Lurcher, here, boy.
Chris went on into the house where he found the letter that laid the last stone in the wall of his misfortune. It came from Harry Maine.
They've brought me news about how Cliff died. I'm coming down into your valley as soon as I can. That ought to be by about Thursday. I suppose that you'll want to meet me somewhere around Royaltown. Wherever you say will suit me fine. I'm coming to Yates's saloon to talk to old Yates, and you could leave a message with him for me. Yours very truly, Harry Maine.
It was also very quietly written, and so rather gentle in a way that Christopher could hardly believe that the quiet words which he'd been reading could have flowed from the pen of the man whose terrible guns had brought him such a crimson fame throughout the land. But after all, Christopher knew perfectly well the loud-mouthed and cursing heroes are of a very inferior breed compared with the silent and workmanlike gunfighters who build their fame by actions rather than by boasts. He read and reread that letter, and then he showed it to his mother. She read it with care, as though it were a much longer document.
I'm sorry, because I had hoped that you would not be destroying such a thorough man as this letter seems to be from. I had hoped that you would simply be facing a vagabond and a bullying scoundrel. But it seems that Harry Maine is not that sort. It's a very good letter, Chris. Don't you think so, dear?
He could nod in answer to this.
One feels so much assured strength and self-reliance in it. And no cursing and no boasting and no threatening. In fact, it's just the sort of letter that I would hope to see you write, Chris, if you were in a similar position.
If one of my brothers were killed, would you want me to ride down to murder the murderer, Mother?
He filled with curiosity. He listened to her with a sort of detached interest, although he knew her answer beforehand.
No, I shouldn't expect you to do anything like that. Not trail until your older brothers had ridden out first, I mean to say.
But suppose that they all went down, one after the other.
Oh, of course you would go! Why do you ask such a foolish question?
Because in some parts of the country, they think that the law should be left to handle such work as this.
In some parts of the land, the law is a grown-up force. But it's not grown up out here. It's simply a child. And one poor sheriff has less chance of keeping order among the wild men of these mountains than a single little boat would have of police in the seven seas. So that's why there's a different code. And there has to be. Manhood is the mainly important thing. Just sheer manhood. That's what we have to worship out here.
He could see no use in trying to persuade her into another viewpoint. For she had lived so long in this land and had grown so inured to its strange ways that she couldn't feel or think in any fashion other than this. She believed in the lynch law for cow and horse thieves, for instance, and there was on record a case when she masked herself and rode with the mob to see justice done. And yet, there was very little of the iron to be seen in her face. She was rather a small woman, delicately made, and her hand was smaller indeed than the hand of Georgia Lassiter. Her carriage was as daintily erect as Georgia's, too, and her laughter had almost as young a ring in it. Youth might wear a different face in Mrs. Royal, but its heart was not greatly altered.
There are still 40 or 50 years for growing old, and I'll never use them all. One of these horses will finish me one of these days, or else one of our enemies will creep up and shoot me. I only hope that it's not in the back. I only hope that I can see my death coming straight before me. I don't think that I'll flinch.
That was not an affectation, but the actual state of her mind and of her desires. She had lived like a lady all her life, but she wanted to die with her boots on, like a man.
I don't know that my granddaughters will have much use for me, but I want all my grandsons to be able to look up to my memory.
That was the reason why Christopher, hearing her speak in this fashion, could not help wishing that some of the manhood she worshipped, and which she also possessed in such a degree, could be stolen away and placed in his own heart. But he saw that for the first time in his life, he would be able to draw no comfort from her. But the way she saw the matter was far closer to the manner in which Harry Maine was seeing it than it was to the viewpoint of her own son. Chris went up to his room and sat there in a brooding silence. He could see that there was no cause for changing his earlier decision. And if he could manage to slip away from the house that very night, he had better do so, because there were only 2 days left before the announced date of the arrival of Harry Maine. And before that time, he must be far, far away, leaving a small track to be followed, as followed he must be. He had made himself quite jolly through that evening, because he knew he was making his last impression, save one, upon his family. In the course of the evening, Peter Royal commented on his seeming lightheartedness.
I wish that I had your fine nerve, Chris, to stand up to the music like this while every minute is bringing that devil closer and closer.
Christopher sat alone in his room, brooding over this, sitting by the window and looking into the dark, deep face of night. He thought of the phone call from Georgia that night.
I had to speak to you again today, Chris. I've had a dreadful feeling all the time, as though you were slipping away from me. No, it's not prophetic. It's only fear. It's only fear, Chris. But oh, I wish the thing were over with.
He had said goodnight to her hastily, for the sound of her voice sent a thrilling weakness through all of his veins, and he felt he had hardly the strength to support himself. He turned out the lights and lay down to rest a little if he could, but the blackness swirled above him and stifled him like the beating of wings of enormous moths. Time dragged on miserably until, at length, the house grew quieter, then silence, and he knew that he alone lay awake, or should be awake. He made up his pack for the trip. He made it small, consisting of the barest essentials, so that it could be done into a tight roll inside his slicker. He had in mind the horse he would take. It was the flea-bitten roan Samson gave him as a birthday present the year before. The gelding would never tire at his work, wherever it led.
No, the rifle.
Peter's rifle was just the last thing in the world that he wished to forget and leave behind him, so he reached into the closet to find it. Pulling it out, the old bamboo fishing rod swayed out and tapped its slender stem against his forehead. He stood for a moment in the darkness, gripping it, and remembering with a sudden rush a thousand things out of his boyhood, when he had first learned to use that rod. He saw again the windings of the creeks, and the creaming surfaces of the little rapids, and the broad, brown faces of the pools, where the fish lurked beneath the fallen logs along the banks. He saw himself once more trudging home with the rod on his shoulder and the dangling fish snapping their lank tails at the dust. And he heard his voice raised with the voices of his companions, proclaiming lustily what manner of men they should be when they grew up. Ah, there would be no cowardice in them, surely. He remembered the day that a wave of scorn ran over the boys in the school when they heard how a forgotten outlaw walked into a bank in broad daylight, held up the cashier and three or four others, made them open the safe, and shoveled the contents into a sack, which he then carried away with him, mounted his horse, and cantered cheerfully and unharmed away from the city. Ah, how the schoolboys raged when they heard of it. Had only a few of them been in that town of Cravens, they would have upheld the law in a more fitting manner. But they had not been there, and little Christopher Royal, lying awake in his excitement at night, dreamed long and wildly of what things he should accomplish when he grew older. He thought of this as his hand closed around the narrow shaft of the fishing rod, and then he turned sadly away and closed the door. For he felt, gloomily, that he had shut away one part of himself in that closet, and all his hopes of what he might be were confined with the old toys, in the dark of that little space. Then he hurried from the room, opening the door with care lest some squeaking of the hinges might betray him. But as he stepped out, he tripped and stumbled heavily over a form which lay in the hall just outside the door. It was Lurcher, who now came cringing to him and licked his hand by way of apology.
Damn it, Lurcher!
The noise he had made might have caught the attention of his mother, who was a very light sleeper. But after listening a moment and finding all silent in the house, he went softly down the stairs to the lower floor. The side door creaked badly, so he did not attempt that, but spent a moment sliding the bolts of the front door gently back, and then turned the big key slowly, without making the slightest whisper of sound. After that, he slung his pack over his shoulder and turned for a last look at the old house. As he did so, he saw a glimmering form on the lowest landing of the stairs, and then he made out his mother's face as she watched him. It was characteristic of her that she had not cried out to him, but there could be no doubt that she understood. The pack at his back and the rifle in his hand and the hour of the night could mean only one thing. So he stood confounded before her, and she came finally down to him.
Then we were all wrong, Christopher. After all, you couldn't stand it?
No. After all, I couldn't stand it.
She sat down and drew her white dressing gown closer around her because the night air was chill. And though she did not speak, her eyes never moved from his face. And he knew that her stern heart was breaking.
Will you say something, Mother?
What can I say, Christopher? I know that your own heart has said all of these things to you before me.
He nodded, dumb with shame and remorse.
What are your plans?
To go somewhere far off. I don't know where. And take a new name and try for a new life.
She shook her head.
Someone from this part of the country would be sure to find you and tell what you had done.
I suppose there's a chance of that.
And then?
Then I'd have to move on again.
Oh, Christopher. A man can die only once.
He bowed his head.
And if you stayed, and if you fought, heaven wouldn't let you lose. It couldn't. And you've already won once.
He could not lift his head to answer. He began to tremble from head to foot.
In Georgia?
He did raise his head then.
I've thought of Georgia every minute.
Why, if that doesn't stop you, then I suppose I've no influence whatever. And still, I can't help talking. I wish that I could disguise myself and pass for you. How gladly I'd take a gun and face him. Oh, how gladly, Christopher, if that would save you.
He felt the lash and winced.
Christopher, you've already met one of them and beaten him. Do you think of that?
I didn't know who he was, not till afterward. And even before, strangely that I didn't know, I was in a blue funk. And when Samson and the rest hear what I've done...
He looked out at her and found her watching him with a cold eye of agony.
It's the fear of death? It's not knowing what will happen after death?
No, it's not death. I don't think that's what tears me in two. But there's a dread feeling in standing up to a man who actually wants your life. And seeing his eyes turn to fire and a grin like a beast on his mouth. It's seeing a man turn into a beast and then being filled with a horror of the thing that he's become. And, God, what's the use of trying to explain? Because it's cowardice, and I know it, but you don't. You never really felt such a thing, and you never will.
When I was a little child, I was afraid of the dark.
I don't believe that, hardly. But at any rate, you beat it.
I went up to the top room in the tank house and locked the door just at dusk and threw the key out the window. And there I stayed till the morning. It was very hard. But before daylight came, I was no longer afraid of the dark.
How old were you when you did that, Mother?
I was 7, I think, or 6.
I have to go now.
I won't try to persuade you, Christopher. I won't tell you what it means to me, or how big things are made to look small by facing them. I'll say goodbye to you, if I have to.
He took her in his arms and kissed her forehead.
I tell you this, that every day I'll pray for more strength, and when I find the strength, I'm going to come back to Royal Valley and find Harry Maine.
She stood nodding and trying pitifully to smile as though she believed the lie. He could not endure the strain for another moment, and whirling away from her, he caught up his pack and rifle and ran through the door. Her voice stopped him.
What are your plans?
He turned, glad that he had the darkness of the night to cover his face.
Christopher, only tell me where you're going, so that I'll know how to pray for you and where to turn my face toward you.
I'm going up to the woods beyond Emmett's. You remember that little cabin where we camped one summer 6 years ago?
I'll think of you there, dear.
Oh, Mother, forgive me if you can.
He ran blindly through the night.